Hello and welcome to volume 137 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss the use of drones in forestry. We'll finally figure out how to do the reforestation deduction. We'll see how the timber market is looking, and we'll discuss hunting cabins. This program is brought to you through the generous contribution of Forester Search, a service that makes it easier to connect landowners with consulting foresters. You can access the site through foresterssearch.com, or there's a link on this page, and you'll be given a roster of consulting foresters who can guide you through the next steps you'll face as a forest landowner. I'm Hayes Brown with the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. This is our second program on hunting cabins, and today we wanted to speak with Brock Ray about the cabins he builds. His cabins are especially adapted for the do-it-yourselfer and can also serve multiple purposes. Welcome, Brock.
Well, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
What do you think makes your cabin stand out from other cabin companies?
Well, you know, there's a lot of log cabin companies out there that'll build cabins, but what we do different is we don't pre-cut and number our logs. Therefore, it saves the customer between 20 and 25%. Most of our cabins are small cabins, and we do build big ones, but our biggest seller is about 800 square foot.
Okay. Now, are these something that you build on site for the customer, or is it a kit that they assemble themselves?
Well, we do it three different ways. The first way is, of course, we'll sell them the kit. They can put it up themselves. We have a DVD that we can send them if they want to do it themselves. It's not that difficult. Or we can do a dry-in. And a dry-in is basically building the shell. And then our turnkey is I search out in that area electricians and plumbers, get them the best deal and let them deal directly with them, and all the other products that they may need for the cabin, we're a dealer for, so they can go through us and save money.
Okay, so there's several different options. It's flexible.
Yes, sir.
Can the cabins be moved if you have a need to, and how big of a deal is that, moving it?
Well, really only have one that I would recommend moving. The others will be like moving a house. You have to come under, I think, 13 foot. Our cabins are 14 foot without the trailer. So the only one that you could move would be called the Sportsman, and it could be put on skids for people that have land they lease. They can put these cabins and move them when their lease is up.
Okay. What kind of maintenance is involved in a log cabin?
Well, you know, there is a lot of people, they have a misconception of log cabins. They think it's just because it's wood, it's a lot of work, but really it's no different than a traditional house with our cabins. We don't use chinking. All our logs are tongue and groove. But, you know, you have to stain it depending on where the sun hits it the most. The darker the stain, the less maintenance you need, and you can wait just like painting a house. So, you know, you can go 5 years if you go with the darkest stain that we use. You just have to maybe once a year, you know, spray it down with the water. But there's really not a whole lot of maintenance. We use a product that we mix with stain called Tall Star, and you pick it up at any co-op. And you mix that with your stain and takes care of the spiders, the carpenter bees, and so forth.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks, Brock. We appreciate that very much.
Well, thanks for having me.
If you want to see the future, just check out Rentizo's website, which shows a video of a drone applying herbicide to a field of corn. Naturally, we thought of forest land applications, so we wanted to speak with Rentizo's CEO, Michael Ott. Hello, Michael.
Hey, how you doing today?
The video was very interesting. Can you tell us about Rentizo's technology and this drone technology, how it works and what the capabilities are?
Sure. We have autonomous drones, meaning they fly themselves. We program them where we want them to go, and they can spray or spread in fields exactly where you intend them to be. So with our upgraded booms, we're spraying a 14-foot swath, a 14-foot boom, giving a 20-foot swath that'll cover about 14 acres per hour per drone. And Rantizo is also the only company that's legally swarming, meaning that we can fly three drones at once. So we'll cover about 40 acres per hour from our drone swarm.
Okay. Naturally, forest landowners are interested in how this technology could be adapted to forest land. How are you using it currently, and what do you think would be needed to adapt this to forest land uses?
Sure. We're ready to rock and roll for forest land uses. We haven't done a lot of that just because we're based in Iowa, and the majority of what we've done has been crops and sanitization. But we certainly could adapt it readily to forest land needs. So the drone has collision avoidance and terrain following in it. So you'll just set it at the height that you want it to be over the target, and then it'll maintain that height even if there's variances in the field. So if the field has a gentle slope, you can just go up that. Or if there's big gaps, like we were doing a demonstration at a research farm last week, and there was like a stand of corn with like a 6-foot gap in between the plots. So you could actually see the drone kind of dipping down where there was a hole and then going back up. So it follows that, that really, really well.
So it actually can not only follow the topography, but actually follow the vegetation that could be variable, like a tree,
exactly,
for example.
Exactly. Yep. And then we're coming out with something, we call it fruit tree mode, where you can actually spray in three dimensions going around that. So I typically say we're going in two dimensions because, you know, you keep the height relatively constant when you're over a crop. But if you're doing a tree, you got to spray in three dimensions. And that's something that we've worked on, and we'd love the chance to check it out. So to deploy it. So if people want to get on rantizo.com, they can figure out everything that they need, ask us for services. And we've got a nationwide network of contractors that goes from Oregon to Pennsylvania with a heavy focus in the Midwest, but we're looking to expand there.
Now, I think these drones have a 55-pound payload, maximum payload capacity, in order to operate it without a pilot's license. Is that right?
Exactly. The whole weight of the thing, we go out at 54.8 pounds because there's 55-pound limit.
Is it possible with that for the drone to come back and get reloaded and then back out to the place that they stopped?
Exactly. So we'll mark the place that you run out of either your battery or your liquid. You'll come home, reload, and then go right back out to that spot, back up 3 feet, and then continue from there. So it's all tracked, it's all autonomous, all data-driven, so it works very well.
Okay. All right, well, thank you, Michael. We appreciate that very much.
Thank you.
It's easy enough to plant trees. I think we've got that figured out. But what we don't have figured out is how to use the reforestation deduction on our tax return. Jib Davidson can help. Hello, Jib.
Good morning.
You're a keynote speaker at an upcoming Florida Forestry Association meeting. Why is a program needed on the reforestation deduction?
The main reason is there's people that don't take advantage of this like they need to. It's incredible to me still that the number of CPAs and accountants that I have to walk through this process.
Why is that? Why is there why is the knowledge base so thinly applied out there? Is this just some kind of mystical, spooky thing?
Not really a mystical, spooky thing. It requires somebody to read the Internal Revenue Code, and Hayes, as an attorney, you know that stuff can be a little boring. Under the Uniform Capitalization Rules, you have to capitalize these kinds of expenditures, except that timber is specifically excluded per the Internal Revenue Code, but there is a limit of $10,000 per year in a reforestation deduction per qualified timber property. And that's where it gets kind of interesting, because if you have a small reforestation expenditure and you don't exceed $10,000, or if you can prepay, in other words, do your site preparation in 1 year and then your reforestation in the second year, you can spread 10,000 in 1 year, 10,000 in the second year. But what makes it very interesting is this qualified timber property, which is right out of the Internal Revenue Code. So the question becomes, how many qualified timber properties can a landowner own? And it turns out it's an unlimited number. So if you can set yourself up to have 5 qualified timber properties, well, you can have 5 $10,000 deductions or $50,000 worth of deductions in any 1 year through reforestation. So the question becomes, so what is a qualified timber property? And those words are straight out of the Internal Revenue Code. And so the question becomes, well, since a landowner can have as many qualified timber properties as he or she so desires, what are they? Well, the question becomes, there is no definition in the Internal Revenue Code or the Treasury regulations or letters of ruling or any of the other things that we look at for guidance from the Internal Revenue Service. We're on our own. So, qualified timber property. Does that mean you have 100 acres in Alabama and 100 acres in Florida? Okay, separated by geography. Is that two different qualified timber properties? The answer, I think, is absolutely. Well, what happens if you have 100 acres in one county and 100 acres in another county? So, oh, yes, that would be two qualified timber properties. So geography begins to play a role in this. But wait a minute. What happens if you have 200 acres and it's separated by a woods road? Oh, well, that may not be a qualified timber property, but what happens if it's two different soils? What happens if you plant two different species? What happens if it's 100 acres of loblolly and 100 acres of shortleaf or slash pine? Oh, what happens if the planting density is 450 trees per acre and another one is 660 trees per acre, but they're both loblolly? So, in other words, the point is you can come up with as many qualified timber properties as you want as long as it's adequately defined by a certified forester or a registered forester and you have everything documented. You can really take advantage of this.
Okay. Well, that's all some very good tips, and would recommend the Florida Forestry Association meeting if you can attend. So, Jib, thanks for that contribution. We appreciate it very much.
All right. You're welcome.
In our markets chair is Jonathan Smith, Executive Director of TimberMart South. Welcome, Jonathan.
Good morning, Hayes. Thanks for having me on.
How would you describe the recent timber prices in the Southeast and in Alabama?
Well, the best I would say is probably variable, if you will. I think I've even said that COVID-19 confused the system. There have been a lot of shutdowns, but then some mills were shut down completely. Some had shift changes. Others were wide open. So to paint the market with a broad brush, that's been kind of difficult over the last couple of months. But, you know, that's very similar to what we've seen with lots of other things in our world today. Looking specifically at timber prices, Southwide pine products, saw timber, chip and saw, and pulpwood were all down 8 to 10% Southwide compared second quarter 2020 to 2019. Second quarter 2020 Southwide pine saw timber prices averaged around $22.75 with chip and saw around $15.50. If you look at Southwide hardwood saw timber prices, they were flat year over year. With hardwood pulpwood being down about $3 a ton year over year. We attribute that to last spring, 2019, being wet. That had pulpwood prices high going into the summer. But then this year, even with a wet winter, there was a lot of uncertainty surrounding the pandemic, and so the mills were talking about taking downtime, and so stumpage declined. Again, hardwood saw timber is still the leading saw log market in the woods at $30.65 a ton, and both pulpwood prices are around 8.25. If you look specifically at Alabama, Alabama state average pine saw log prices are very similar to Southwide averages at $23.28 and $15.97 for saw timber and chip and saw, respectively. Alabama average pine pulpwood was around $6.44, about $2 below the Southwide price. Your hardwood prices were a premium to the Southwide, about $5 premium at $35 a ton for hardwood sawtimber and $13 a ton for hardwood pulpwood. There aren't really any surprises here. If you look at Alabama as a whole, it's got a lot of diversity in their markets and in geography. But the Alabama pine prices are pretty average compared to the rest of the states and TimberMart South's footprint, whereas the Alabama hardwood prices are some of the strongest in the TMS area.
One of the things you mentioned was the difference between hardwood pulpwood and pine pulpwood. There's a big difference between those two in Alabama, isn't there?
Yes, and, you know, with hardwood sawtimber being as strong as it is in Alabama, the hardwood pulpwood prices follow that, and the lack of markets with pine sawtimber makes a big, pine pulpwood makes a big difference.
Yeah, okay. Well, thank you, Jonathan. We appreciate that very much.
Yes, sir.
That's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Brock Ray, Michael Ott, Jib Davidson, and Jonathan Smith. There's a segment of the forestry community that's often overlooked. Their work is essential, and if they did not do it, it would not get done. I'm referring to the seasonal worker who plants trees and does some of the herbicide and timber stand improvement work. These are non-immigrant workers who take temporary and seasonal work in the U.S. and then return to their country of origin. It's useful to understand how they are different from illegal migrants or even those who work in the hotel and service industries. These workers play by the rules and support the forests, which are a national vital interest. They're temporary. They perform an essential function for us, and they deserve our support. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown. Thank you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.